So what I'm going to do is I have some notes and I have some quotations, and I'm going to use this and then talk about the topic, the multiverse. Okay. It's actually a very complicated subject, extremely complicated. There's no way in a short talk or lecture to get very far into it in detail. So I thought what I would want to do is to give you an overview and some principles that you could use in thinking about the hypothesis. Okay. So here's an outline of my talk. Part one is on the prehistory of the idea in theology and in fiction. Part two, definition and some classifications or some ways of distinguishing multiverses. Part three, some presuppositions that we should examine. Part four, we'll do a brief survey of some versions of the multiverse with a brief assessment in light of the presuppositions. I must say that you wouldn't believe how many different versions of this there are, and they're quite different among themselves. Okay, and then finally, part four, I'm going to circle back to fiction. Okay. Now, prehistory. There was a debate about what was called the plurality of worlds in the Middle Ages among Muslim and Christian scholastics. The question was whether God could, or maybe had to, create other worlds besides the one that we live in. So there were a lot of different views about that. Maybe God couldn't do it. Maybe he could, but didn't. Maybe he had to. Some people, I think maybe some Muslim philosophers especially may have thought that God had to create multiple worlds. Okay, so I just wanted to point out, because this is Thomas Aquinas College, that St. Thomas did discuss this issue, and his view was God could do it, he didn't have to do it, and he didn't. So just in a nutshell, that's what St. Thomas says about it. If you want to, his argument that God didn't do it is not a formal demonstration, but it's a fittingness argument. If you want to talk about that in the Q&A, we can. I think I can basically say what his argument was. Okay, so that's the prehistory in terms of a serious subject. The other bit of prehistory is from fiction, and particularly from the comics. Okay, here I want to read you a couple of quotations for this. So, this is a man named Mark Peters on a website called vocabulary.com, says this. The Oxford English Dictionary traces the idea of a multiverse as a bunch of parallel universes back to 1963 and a poetic sentence from a Michael Moorcock short story. Here's the quotation from Moorcock's story. Jewel, the multiverse spread around him, awash with life, rich with pulsating energy. Doesn't it make you want to read the story? No. Okay. I'm continuing now the quotation from Peters. But the concept, if not the word, goes back just a few years earlier and has its roots in a science fiction influenced genre, comic books. In 1961, The Flash, number 123, introduces the multiverse to comics, and it hasn't left since, he says. This is why you hear things like the DC Universe, the Marvel Universe, and all that business. So it really has a place in the very beginning of this whole modern discussion of the multiverse. But I wanted to point out that the idea is really older than those comic books or that story that he cites. And many of you have probably read C.S. Lewis' The Narnia books, right? So it occurred to me that there's a multiverse in The Magician's Nephew. Remember that story? That's where there's the wood between the worlds, and with the magic rings, they go to the wood in their pools, and every pool leads to a different world. So I thought that was kind of interesting, that idea, or one version of the idea, is in Lewis. Okay. So.
Lewis also does that in the space trilogy, right?
That's a little different, because please feel free to do this. In the space trilogy, they go to the main character goes to Mars and Venus, but those are other planets. They're not other kind of complete.
Okay.
The in Lewis's Narnia books, like Charn is the other. There are three. There's Earth, Narnia, and Charn that we've learned about. Charn, for example, has its own sun, so it's not part of our solar system. And in fact, it doesn't. The only way to get from one universe to the other, one world to the other, there seems to be by using the magic rings, right? Yeah. Whereas in the space trilogy, he gets into some kind of spacefary contraption and is taken to us. Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's a little, just a brief look at the sort of the beginning of the idea in the more modern way. What I want to do now is give you some nominal definitions. Okay. First of universe and then of multiverse. So a universe is a self-contained and causally connected physical system in which we exist as part of the system. Any questions about that?
Can you say it one more time?
Sure. The self-contained and causally connected physical system in which we exist as part of the system. That's the universe. The one
you know. Does that suggest that there'd be, so you say like causally connected, or does that suggest that there's like a different first cause for each of the different universes?
No, I don't think that's an implication. I mean, somebody might think that, but no, that's not implied in that. Because we would say that, I mean, like with St. Thomas, God could have made other causally disconnected cosmoses and cosmoi. And with his conception, the medieval conception of the cosmos, that would mean sphere-fixed stars, right? Probably planets, and then going down to Earth at the center. If God wanted to, he could have made more of those, is what St. Thomas says. One of his arguments that there is only one is just, it's a dialectical argument, is that everything goes to the center, right? So there's the Earth at the center where all the heavy things go, and, you know, that's that kind of defines the universe.
How would that definition, why would that apply to a solar system or a galaxy?
It doesn't. It doesn't. What that means is because, you see, we're causally connected to them in a way. We see light from the galaxies, right? Even the ones we haven't actually seen are potentially visible up to a point. I'll say more about that later. There could be things that are so far away that we couldn't have any connection with them. But they affect us because we see them, right? So there's a causal connection. So all this is part of the universe.
Yeah, but I'm saying, why wouldn't you call that a universe? The galaxy, like the Milky Way galaxy.
Oh, that was an old usage. For a while they called those island universes because they didn't really know, for example, that they're gravitationally connected to us. But the gravitational force extends throughout, even though it gets very, very weak, right, as you get further out. But at the time, I don't think that was clearly understood, but now it is, okay? One quibble I have with this definition is a subtle one, and I'll have to talk about it a little bit later, and that's the use of the word physical, causally connected physical system. Because in some versions of the multiverse, it's questionable whether physical should be in that definition. So we'll come back to that. So with that as a universe, then a multiverse, nominally, would be any collection of universes as defined above. Right? Does that make sense? So if there are more of them, and you have a collection of them, that's the multiverse. So here are some ways in which multiverses can differ from each other. So see, now I'm not only just making the universe plural, but I'm making multiverse plural. and actually, some of them could go together. They don't exclude each other necessarily. Here's some ways in which you could think about them. First of all, how many of them are there? Two or just a few? You see that in fiction and in theology, perhaps? Or infinitely many? Or many, but finite in number? Okay, so those two are the main possibilities we're going to look at. There are a whole bunch of them, but they're finite in number, or they're infinitely many. That's one way of distinguishing them. Another is, how are they related to each other? They could be A, without any causal connection between them, or there could be a partial or limited causal connection between them. All right? In some versions, that's the case. And then finally, I'll mention, in some fiction and in paranormal research, actually, there's the idea of multiverses that are wholly permeable to each other. So we can always make contact. That's pretty weird. That's one of the ways some people account for UFO things, believe it or not. And it, by the way, I can give, if anybody's interested, I can give you a reference to a podcast by and a YouTube channel by a really interesting Catholic man who's an apologist for Catholic Answers. It's called the Jimmy Akin's Mysterious Universe. That's where I learned about the paranormal stuff. So back to this. So again, no causal connection, a partial or limited causal connection. Okay. The next thing is their ontological status. They could be material entities, or realities, let's say, material realities. Or they could be mathematical beings, and that's what's really real. Or they could be mental realities, position that's been called many, not many universes, but many minds. So those are three things we're going to see. We're going to see realistic versions of the multiverse. We're going to see some that we call maybe Platonic or Neo-Pythagorean versions of the multiverse. And finally, idealistic in the Kant, et cetera, sense, versions of the multiverse. Okay. Finally, there's the context in which the multiverse appears, which would be primarily cosmology and particle physics on the one hand, quantum mechanics on the other, and then there may be some other things like in fiction. Okay. So, from fiction to science. Here I'm going to quote from this Mark Peters again from vocabulary.com. So he says, in science, the first known appearance of the word multiverse is a 1990 New Scientist article on wormholes, which this is a quote, this is not me, on wormholes, another sci-fi concept proven real. Here's his quotation, I think, from that article. The wormhole picture changes our view of the origin of the universe in a Big Bang, which is now seen simply as the event corresponding to our universe branching off from the greater multiverse to which we must still be connected by an umbilical wormhole. So he thinks that may be the first appearance in a scientific journal of the word. Now, we certainly can disagree with him about it being a concept proven real. That's, anyway. Not that they're impossible. It's a cool idea, actually. But there's no real proof that they exist. So that is wormholes. not the term multiverse, but the idea arose within physics before that, and that's in Hugh Everett's Many Worlds Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics. That was first proposed in 1957. His paper, I haven't read his paper. It's supposed to be really, really difficult to interpret even what he means by it. So I'll say more about that later. But it's kind of an important version of the multiverse. Now, I want to keep this in mind. Not all the ideas arising in a scientific context are the same or even compatible. So keep in mind that an idea can arise in a scientific context without being scientific, as that is usually understood. A claim belongs to a science simpliciter if it is either an empirical discovery or a testable prediction from an established theory, or perhaps a logical deduction from a well-received theory, or at least a theory that has gained some traction. So all those things could really make it, simply speaking, belonging to science. If it's not that, if an idea is not that, even if it appears in a scientific context, it may be a philosophical position rather than a scientific one, as science is understood here, or it may be simply conjectural, a guess. And if it's conjectural, it could arise for all sorts of reasons, including wishful thinking. Okay. Or just being very imaginative. All right. So let's go to this. What I've done now is I've shown you that there is a history of the idea of the multiverse going back to at least 1957. Now, here are some commonly found presuppositions one finds in these theories. Or I don't even want to call them theories. They're not theories. They're hypotheses. Okay. Note that not all the versions assume all of these presuppositions. Here's the first one, that there can exist at one and the same time an actually infinite number of things. Okay. Like the people who hold that the line is made up of points. Here, there's commonly a presupposition that you can have an actual infinity of these universes. Question for them, how are they going to answer Zeno's paradoxes? I don't know. Okay. Here's the second one. That everything possible is actual. This has in it the first presupposition, because possibilities are infinite, right? So if you think that all the possibilities are actual, you believe there's an actual infinite. But this one goes a lot farther. So this one's a little funny. I think when I've seen it, generally the range of things that they're thinking about when they say everything possible is actual is somewhat limited. They don't really mean it in every strict way that you could mean it. I mean, I just thought of this crazy example. If everything possible is actual, then there's another universe in which, say, Mrs. Green in Ojai, she has a statue of Mary, and it's got a little dust mote on it, and instead of being the dust mote in this universe, it's one that's X microns smaller in size, right? And where X is any real number. So there are infinitely many. Where all they differ in is how big that little dust mote is. Everything else is exactly the same. So if you really took this premise strictly, you'd have to say things like that. I don't think people think about that, and that they probably don't mean it. So again, they don't, but I don't know in principle how they rule that out. So if, for example, they say there are infinitely many universes in which every possible value of the speed of light exists, well, that's a particular, right? And, you know, so I'm not sure in principle how they rule out the Mrs. Green example, although we can just see it sounds absurd. Okay. Third presupposition now, that all possible versions of the laws of nature and the values of the fundamental constants are equally probable. So this, in a way, comes out of this idea of, again, all the possibilities being actual. So they want to limit it, generally in the discussions, they want to limit it to the physical laws, what they are, and all those constants of nature, like the speed of light, the electron mass, the ratio of the gravitational force to the electromagnetic force, all those things. So they want all possible versions of that to exist. And they tend to think of them as all equally probable. So all of them have to exist somewhere, they'll say, right? Just as all numbers on a fair die will come up eventually, if it's, you know, you keep tossing it, you're going to get 1 through 6, you know, get all the numbers. So they say, well, you've got to get universes with all possible values of these things. Who's the cosmic dice player? Don't ask that. You know, right? That's not something you want to ask. What's causing these dice to be rolled? Okay. Fourth one, and this doesn't apply to all of the versions, of course, but it's that there's no contingency in nature. That cause means a necessary, efficient cause. And so if that's all you would mean by a cause, then you're not admitting any natural contingency. Okay. Occurred to me, too, that another view, another version, the one that is more mathematical, would take cause to mean only formal cause, I think, right? Other sort of Platonic versions. But a limitation in the notion of cause. Finally, let me mention that a common presupposition of people who believe in the universe, multiverse, is that there's no other explanation why our universe would contain us, would contain life. We are too improbable from a mathematical point of view, right? So they say, well, okay. That's that quotation on the chart. That came from one of the books I looked at, or actually from an article. But it says it well in a way. If you don't want to have God, you better have a multiverse, because then you can say, well, it's too unlikely that we'd be here just by chance. That might not be right. I don't know. But anyway, that's what they say. And therefore, in order to get us, or even to get a universe that has any kind of life, we need to have, if not infinitely many, lots and lots and lots of them.
So finally we turned up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the versions of the anthropic principle. They say, well, I want to talk about that now. Why is the universe so suited? Not only just suited, but it seems like it's fine-tuned for life and for human life. Why would that be? They say it should be the result of some random process, right? Because there's no intelligibility to, you know, the universe as a whole. Why are we here? So it must be that there's something going on that we don't understand, or there's infinitely many possibilities, and so we're lucky. We just happen to be in one of the ones that has life. I mean, why are we here? Well, we're lucky. You know, the roll of the dice for us made it possible for us to exist. Okay. There are many, many more universes in which there isn't life. Not only that, but it turns out with many, if not most, tweakings that you might do to those constants of nature, many of them, you wouldn't even get stars or galaxies. Because having the universe that we have depends upon, for example, the particular ratio of electromagnetic force to gravitational force, how strong absolutely those forces are. For the universe as a whole, there's a really interesting argument in a book by Roger Penrose called The Road to Reality. I can't go into it, it's very, very complicated, but it's interesting if you look at it, where he thinks the most jaw-dropping thing is the amount of entropy that was in the Big Bang at the beginning. And when he looks at that, the odds against there even being a coherent universe are so small that I think what he thinks is that there's some physics missing that we don't know yet. We'll see why it's necessary, right, that the world is here. But we don't have that physics. And he doesn't buy the multiverse. He thinks that's a cop-out. Okay.
You said a cop-out?
A cop-out, yeah. I have a couple of other people who say similar things. Right. But does that way of... I mean, you see what that way of argument is again, right? We're so unlikely. How are we going to... How is it going to be that we're going to be here? Because there's no rational principle in being, right, that would explain us. So let's just have lots of universes. Maybe infinitely many of them with all possible values of the constants and the laws. So, I'll do this right now. I think, I'm kind of jumping ahead, but I think I want to read a couple of, since I mentioned Penrose, a couple of quotations I have here from scientists reflecting on this move to the multiverse. This is a book called, this is a really interesting book called The Singular Universe and the Reality of Time. It's by a man named, two men, Roberto Unger and Lee Smolin. And one thing I love about this book, although I don't agree with a lot of things in it, but they take seriously the need to have a natural philosophy again and not just technical science. And I think that's really, really important that some scientists are seeing that. So here's a quotation from their book. The multiplication of universes in contemporary cosmology has not resulted from any empirical discovery or inference from observation. It has been the outcome of an attempt to convert, through this fabrication, an explanatory failure into an explanatory success. The sleight of hand represented by this combination of ideas amounts to an ominous turn in the history of science. That's pretty strong. Pretty strong language there, right? Here's another quotation. This is from a man named George Ellis. This is from an article in the journal Astronomy and Geophysics, volume 49, issue 2. He says, "The very nature of the scientific enterprise is at stake in the multiverse debate. Its advocates propose weakening the nature of scientific proof in order to claim that the multiverse hypothesis provides a scientific explanation. This is a dangerous tactic. Two central scientific virtues are testability and explanatory power. In the cosmological context, these are often in conflict with each other, and there has been an increasing tendency in theoretical physics and cosmology to say that it does not matter whether a proposal is testable. If it fits into our other theories in a convincing way, with great explanatory power, then testing is superfluous. The extreme case is the multiverse proposal, where no direct observational test of the hypothesis is possible. Despite this, many articles and books dogmatically proclaim that the multiverse is an established scientific fact." So there's some scientists giving their... And if you look at other... There are other parts of physics, too, where you can see some of the scientists questioning the path that science is on right now towards more and more reliance on theoretical ideas and aesthetics, even, and philosophical presuppositions, and not on any empirical evidence. Okay, so got to skip it a little bit there, but I thought that kind of went with what I was talking about. Okay, so here what I want to do now. I told you this is going to be a little bit chaotic. What I want to do now is to talk about some of the versions of the multiverse, if I can find my sheet. I've already been talking about them, but actually the main versions are from cosmology or from quantum mechanics, and I don't want to do quantum mechanics first, so I'm going to put that down here. Somewhere in here. Well, maybe I'll just talk about it. I probably don't need my paper. The idea in cosmology came out from, developed out of Big Bang Theory, but a particular version of Big Bang Theory. The original version of the theory seemed not to have an explanation of things that people thought were puzzling. Some of those things they thought were puzzling because they don't want anything to be special, right? So, for example, that the universe, leaving aside small, local variations because of general relativity, but the overall geometry of the universe seems possibly to be Euclidean, and that seems too special. Okay, so that was a puzzle. Some of them are more significant, I think. So that one is a rough thermal equilibrium of the cosmos. Well, that too, they thought, didn't seem like that. I mean, if it's kind of random how it comes out, why would it be so uniform, right? And similarly with the distribution of matter, it's not perfectly uniform, obviously, but on large scales it is. So they wondered about that. So, but also there were some reasons to think that the timing of things wasn't working out well. So this version called inflation came about. It has nothing to do with dollars, you know. The universe doesn't cost anything, I guess. But the idea of inflationary cosmology is that, I don't know, a few microseconds after the Big Bang, suddenly space-time became huge. So it went from being, I don't know, singularity or very little of anything, to being, most of its growth happened all at once, or in a very short period of time. And that would allow you to do things like whatever irregularities in temperature and matter there at the beginning, that kind of got averaged out, right, when you make it big. I think that's that idea. So a further development of the inflationary cosmology was the idea that as universes form, other universes kind of bubble off from them. They use that imagery of bubbling. So you got a universe, another bubbles off, another bubbles off. You get a kind of fractal pattern. That's what was being referred to in one of those quotations where it talked about wormholes connecting them, right? So, and for some reason they think, well, you know, they're going to have different constants and laws. I don't know. There's no principal reason for that as far as I can tell. But, you know, that's what you say. So that's how you get infinitely many on this picture. That makes sense. Okay. A more modest version of the multiverse in cosmology, one that's much more plausible, to me anyway. I don't, partly because the other one depends upon a lot of questionable physics, things that are highly speculative like string theory that are really not even in favor nowadays. I think the heyday of this other stuff was in the 90s, more or less. But another version is that, with inflation, is that there are some regions of the universe that are so far away they can't be causally connected to us. The way that comes about is that the expansion of the Big Bang is actually faster than the speed of light. That's what the empirical evidence says, really. So that means that since causal connections for us happen at the speed of light, there could be regions of the of what in some ways one universe. I like what Penrose calls it. He calls it the unium. The unium. That are causally disconnected. And so in that way, you could call it a multiverse. So that's one. Another view from the Big Bang is a possibility that instead of just having a Big Bang, you have a Big Crunch, too. So you have expansion of the universe. If there's enough mass energy to bring it back to slow the acceleration, this is a little out of date, too, I think. Then it would come back together again in a Big Crunch, and it happened again. This is my Buddhist version of the multiverse, in a way, right? So like Brahman and Shiva, creation and destruction, you know, one after the other. Okay. Yeah. So those are basically the cosmological versions. Is that okay? To understand them in detail takes a lot of work. All right. The quantum one is even weirder and even harder to explain. I don't know how much I can do with this, but I'm going to try. Does anybody know anything about, do you know something about quantum mechanics, anybody? So I assume you do. Well, it's a huge subject, but I think I do have to mention this. Two key ideas in standard quantum mechanics is that you have the wave function. But you, some of you, at least those of you who are seniors, know what a wave function is. This is a complex wave function that is formally somewhat like the one you'd study in senior lab, but somewhat different also. That evolves deterministically according to what. So you like it in physics, right? You like them when things are deterministic. So you have a system. It could be just one electron. It could be like a cup of coffee. Or it could be finally the whole universe. Okay. So when they push this, they say there's a wave function for the whole universe, which should just be a superposition or a combination of all the particular, the little wave functions. It's got a perfectly definite mathematics. And then there's some theories about how, given electromagnetism, given gravity, with those theories, how in a given scenario, like you've got so much mass here and there, you've got so many charges, you can deterministically show how the wave function evolves. Now, the wave function is a mathematical being. Okay, it's not what Mrs. Gusson used to call pinchy stuff. Yeah. I love that. That was her name for real matter, pinchy stuff, right?
Yeah.
So the wave function is not that. Right. What happens when you make a measurement or an observation is what they call, some people call, the collapse of the wave function. So you may have heard of Schrodinger's cat. That's one of the common examples that you use, right? So you've got an experiment in which you have a cat, and there's, of course, the experiment has a wave function that involves the wave function of the cat and all this stuff. And there's some gadget with a radioactive material that's either going to release a poison or not release the poison. But there's just the wave function until you observe or make a measurement. This is the old kind of Copenhagen way of looking at things. So you open the box and, gee, the cat's either dead or alive, right? One or the other. Because it can't, in actuality, be both. So the wave function is not talking about actuality. It's talking about potentialities is what it's talking about. Okay. But something you do causes the wave function to collapse. Now, the problem is that that's not a deterministic process. It's qualitatively different from the evolution of the wave function, which is nice, physical, deterministic. You don't know until you do it whether you're going to get a live or a dead cat. Even worse, I mean, it isn't just a choice between two things either. It's like, you know, if you have something moving along, you're going to stop it. It potentially infinitely many places it could stop right within your context. So until you stop it, you don't know where it is, right? Which, in a way, that's kind of a good idea. That's true, really. So the problem for these people, for a lot of these people, is they don't like the... As I mentioned, one of the presuppositions that's common is that you don't like contingency. You don't want nature to be contingent. So you're tearing your hair out with quantum mechanics, right? Because you've got this part of it that, you know, is just not, it's not, to them it seems irrational. That's what it seems to them. Okay. So how does the multiverse get around that? Well, you say that whenever an observation is made or a measurement or anything, maybe just looking at it, the universe splits into two. So there's a world in which the cat's alive, there's a world in which the cat's dead. There's a world in which the electron's here, 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 and all the infinite possibilities in between. See? So this version involves the actuality of all the potentials, that they're all actual somewhere. Interesting idea. So, but again, that was in Hugh Everett's paper, this guy who wrote in 57. A number of physicists have mulled it over and come up to a different way of interpreting it. I don't necessarily think they believe it. They may or may not, but they think this may be what Everett meant. And they call it not many worlds, but many minds. So imagine that you, sitting right there, there's the continuum of yous, because all the collapses are not, there really is no pinchy matter. Again, this is that Neo-Pythagorean or idea, I think just the idealist version. Bishop Berkeley would like this, right? So really what there are only are only minds. And not only that, but every mind is an infinite continuum of minds. This guy, David Albert, and I think Penrose, think that's what Everett had in mind. So... not so much just a Platonic or Neo-Pythagorean. What really is real is the mathematics, you know, that...
But
all our conscious experience is just like this, the shadows in the cave, right? It's not, they're not very real. Here, even the shadows aren't real. It's just the mind. So very, very weird. But I had to bring that up because that's... now, obviously, depends on philosophical positions. That doesn't even pretend to be science. It's a philosophical interpretation or take on what on the actual science. Okay. And it's definitely a minority view.
Okay. Could you just say one more thing in the Neoplatonic version, what shadows are, what's cast?
Oh, sure. Right. Have you read The Republic yet?
No. Yeah. I'm in the
how the analogy. Oh, how? Yeah, I just want to make sure. Okay. One could think that this is I call it kind of a Pythagorean version of Platonism, because you may think that the thing that's real are not just any old forms, but mathematical forms. That's what the real reality is, right? So those would be like the objects that are making the shadows, so that those are the real things. And we have this conscious experience of a world that seems touchy-feely, right? And so these people, and I'm not kidding, you can find people who really say this. That's really just a subjective experience. It isn't what's really real. Yeah. So you can see how this leads to finally to the other version, right? That it's really just in our minds, and our minds are all there are, really. That's where math is, they would say, maybe, in our minds. And you wouldn't have to have a multiverse view. You could just think that's the way the world is. But these people who want to get rid of the paradoxes in quantum mechanics say, well, all we have to say is that all the possibilities exist in people's minds. And whoever thinks about it, you know, they've got it in their mind. One version of it is in every version of their mind. It's kind of weird. Weirder than most science fiction, right? Is it okay if I go back to science fiction now? I think that's the true home for the multiverse. Why is it good in science fiction? It's a great vehicle for storytelling, don't you think? We love asking, what if? What if this? What if that? Usually what you see in science fiction is some alternate world. They don't deal with lots of them usually. But some alternate world. And that's really fun because we do like to think about counterfactuals, you know? Here's just some examples that I've read and that are seen and that I like. You can throw out some examples of your own if you'd like. It's the premise of Star Trek's Mirror Universes. I don't know if anybody else is a Star Trek fan, but the first one was called Mirror Mirror. That's in the original series. And then some of the other series have stories that are set in... And in the Mirror Universe, the good characters become bad and the bad characters become good. So that's a kind of reversal, which is an interesting idea. So that's one way of doing it. Another Philip K. Dick's book, The Man in the High Castle, you may have heard about that because there's, a Netflix show based on it. It's probably no good. But anyway, the book is good. It imagines that that Germany won World War II. Okay, that's the premise there. What would that be like? If you like something more in the more fantastic genre, there's some actually really interesting and quite good books by a woman named Naomi Novik. Is set in a world in which dragons, intelligent dragons, articulate dragons exist. And the story is set in the Napoleonic era, so you get a neat mixture of fantasy and historical fiction. They're kind of fun in a way. His Majesty's Dragon is the name of the first one. Occasionally you get more than one, the alternate universe, like I mentioned Narnia. Another one is the Next Generation, Star Trek Next Generation story, The Pegasus. I don't know if any of you seen that. In that one, towards the end, a whole bunch of different versions of the Enterprise start showing up with Will Riker as the captain, and most of them have been more or less destroyed by the Borg. So it's kind of fun. And there's always you have to come up with some reason, right, in a story why this kind of thing would happen. So what is it? It's a space-time anomaly, right? That's a good one. It's something that happens because the antimatter starship drive. Something goes wrong with that. It's a transporter accident. There are all kinds of, you know, ways of getting it. So there's one example of a novel I know that takes the very idea of the multiverse and controversy about it as part of the actual story. I don't really recommend this book as being a great fiction. It isn't, I don't think. It's got a lot of flaws. And it's also not the first in the series. But it is interesting in that it is about multiverse. It's a book called The Firebird by Jack McDevitt. Some of the issues that I brought up were kind of explicitly brought up in the book. There, a physicist who was very interested in trying to find, to get to another universe, one of these, disappears. And, of course, everybody wonders, did he find a way to get into one of them? Of course, what turned out what happened was his wife was cheating on him with his best friend, who, actually, they did get somewhere, but it was probably in this universe, and the friend stranded him there and went back. He gets his comeuppance, though, because as soon as he gets back, the wife kind of rejects him, and he goes out, and there's a big earthquake, and he gets killed. So he gets his comeuppance. Anyway, that's by the by. So anyway, those are some examples. And in a minute, if you want to give some, you can. But finally, I want to say this. In a way, I'm not satisfied with calling the multiverse a fiction. I think maybe it deserves to be called a myth, in which I don't just mean a falsehood, but in a more respectful sense. A myth is a story that's imaginative and often symbolic, and it might or might not point to something true, right? They're not inductions from experience. They're not deductions from logical or probable arguments, even. They're stories to help us make sense of the complex and confusing world we live in. They may be integrated into a religion, or they may not, but they are always addressed to our sense of wonder. The grandest myths are stories about the origin of the world or the origin of mankind. If we assent to, that's what the multiverse is, really. It's a story about origins. If we assent to a myth, it's not a scientific assent. It's not by way of opinion. It's really by faith, if we assent to it. So why might we call the multiverse a myth? Because it is a story of origins. It is poetic. And that is why writers of science fiction and fantasy find it so useful. It is not a scientific theory. As a philosophical claim, it is flawed because it is so unlikely on the face of it, and it rests on some dubious or simply false notions. As a myth, it does not descend into particular details of inflationary cosmology or quantum mechanics. It's a product of the mythopoeic imagination of mankind. The end.